I'd like to call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum. First order of business will be the minutes from the 17th of February meeting. Do I have a motion?
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Josh, I've never pronounced your name yet. Heintzman.
Heintzman.
Heintzman. Very good. So Representative Heintzman has moved the minutes. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. Well, I can sense some anticipation in the room here. Got very quiet. And President Kaler, I'm very happy to see you here this afternoon. And we look forward to your presentation. I'm going to put the gavel down. And President Kaler, you can begin your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Nornes, members of the committee. I'm Eric Kaler. It's my honor and privilege to serve as the president of the University of Minnesota. I am joined, with your approval, in my presentation by Medical School Dean Brooks Jackson and faculty member Lynn Behringer, who will speak in support of our request. I'm also joined either presently or in the near future by the Chair of the Board of Regents, Richard Beeson, and Regents Cohen, Devine, Lucas, and Simmons, and I appreciate their support in attending today. You have a handout of the slides that I will show you in front of you. Excuse me. The story of the University of Minnesota in 2015 is one of accountability, affordability, and achievement. It's underscored by our commitment to operational excellence, a partnership with the state to fuel innovation in Minnesota, and by the ambition of our students, faculty, and staff. Our biennial budget request to this legislature demonstrates all of that and more, and builds on the accomplishments of our institution and our people. For example, as you know, as part of our partnership with you in fiscal year 2014, we accomplished and in fact exceeded all five performance measures set forth by the legislature. We improved graduation rates for low-income students on our Twin Cities campus. We increased the total number of undergraduate STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees on the Twin Cities campus. We improved overall graduation rates. We increased inventions disclosures, 343 invention disclosures, all driven, as the saying goes, by discovery. We decreased administrative costs by $15 million. And as this slide shows, we're on a pace to reduce our administrative costs by $90 million over 6 years, and we're already ahead of schedule. In addition to having exceeded these goals, as the state's only comprehensive research university, we are improving and competing at the highest level among the nation's best public university. A point of bragging, if you'll allow me in Minnesota to do so. For the first time, as this slide shows, we have been ranked in the top 25 in nine comprehensive categories by the respected Center for Measuring University Performance at Arizona State University. These are areas that range from research dollars to endowment assets to National Academy members to postdoctoral appointees and to the preparation of our entering class. And for the first time, we are among only a handful, eight other peer institutions that rank so high in these nine diverse categories. Our company includes UC Berkeley, UCLA, Florida, Illinois, Michigan, Texas, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Wisconsin, Madison. So if you want to say this is a top 10 university, top 10 public research universities in the country, you can, because it's true. And like each of these great research universities, we are an economic engine for the state. Since I became president 4 years ago, I've said we must be among the conversation of the nation's best public research universities. And we are, not just in funding, but in honors, quality of students and faculty, and operational efficiency. As an engine of the state's innovation culture, last year we set a university record of creating 15 startup companies. That helps create a total of 67 of them in the past 8 years, creating jobs and economic impact, as this slide shows. From our campuses to our extension offices to our research and outreach center, that impact is wide and deep across the entire state. As a leader in agribusiness and food, our campuses in Crookston and Morris, along with scholars on the Twin Cities campus, are deeply involved in preparing the next generation of ag industry leaders along with our extension educators. In Duluth, we're leading efforts in freshwater research, a critical area for a world where water will be the oil of the 21st century, and in mining and applied research through the Natural Resources Research Institute. In Rochester, we're partnering with Mayo Clinic while growing a unique health-focused campus. The focus on healthcare training and delivery is statewide, and this slide shows our academic health center's extensive affiliation agreements. We refer this in-house as the measles slide. This shows a spot in every county, that nearly every county, and is an illustration of the tremendous statewide impact of the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. I come here today with this request seeking to strengthen our partnership with you to benefit our students, their families, Minnesotans' health, and the state's economic vibrancy, from its urban core to our rural towns and cities. Now, before I review the specifics, I'd like to explain how we develop our requests with the oversight and approval of our Board of Regents. When putting this request together, we consider our current activities, that is, what we've done in the previous years. We determine if they are achieving the desired outcomes and if we want to continue doing them. Are they valuable? And we look for opportunities for investment to improve the university for our students, our faculty, and the state. Each year, we do stop low-value activities and reallocate those funds against new priorities and investments, such as the initiatives I am presenting today. We then recognize the inflationary cost adjustment that our business requires. For example, we have increases in the cost of subscriptions for our libraries. Our students and families need increased financial aid. And we must retain and attract world-class talent by providing appropriate compensation. When that process is done, we have two options to fill a gap. One is to ask for a tuition increase from our students and their families, and the second is to make a request to the state of Minnesota. In the past biennium and in this one, we've decided not to ask our students and families for a tuition increase, but rather to continue to rebalance our partnership with the state so that it helps fund operations of university in the next biennium. This request and our budget reflects our values, our vision, and our commitment to our students, their families, and to Minnesota's prosperity. This year, that's embodied in four simple and focused goals of this request. One, become more affordable and accessible to qualified students by freezing tuition for Minnesota residents. Two, improve our facilities. Three, improve the state's health. And four, spur economic development. As you know, it has been a priority of mine to work diligently and tirelessly to ensure University of Minnesota education is affordable. We are again requesting funds for operations in an amount that will enable a tuition freeze for Minnesota residents, and it is our top priority in this request. This year, we're proposing to extend that freeze beyond undergraduates to graduate and professional students. We seek funding for operations so that there will be no tuition increase for the 15-16 and 16-17 academic years for all Minnesota resident students. We'll use these resources to invest in essential faculty, facilities, and operations. Minnesota resident undergraduate, graduate, and professional students will be guaranteed a two-year reprieve from tuition increases on all University of Minnesota campuses. This benefit would accrue throughout their degree program and benefit future students and families, too. It would reduce the total burden on students and families by approximately $65 million for the biennium. For an incoming first-year student, it reduces total undergraduate tuition burden by between $2,100 to $2,600 over 4 years. Impacts on graduate and professional students vary from $1,600 for a master's student to over $5,000 for a medical school student. And approximately 53,000 students and their families in Minnesota would benefit annually from this investment. This is a plot, I am an engineer, of total state investment and tuition per capita student over time, which is a measure of university spending on each student. These dollars are corrected for inflation. They're constant 1997 dollars. What you should note is that over this period of time, less than 20 years, we've been able to reduce the cost to graduate a student by about 11%. Even as our total enrollment over this 18-year period has increased by 24%, from 49,000 to 61,500 seeking degrees this past fall. In 1997, the state paid 70% of that cost, and the families paid 30%. This year, the state's investment covers only 42%, while students and families pick up the other 58%. And I believe we should rebalance that partnership. Let me move to the next part of our request, the need to maintain our facilities. It's critical to have facilities of today to prepare students for the workforce of tomorrow. Although we are engaged in online education in a serious way, the University of Minnesota is still primarily a place-based institution, and I believe we will be so for generations to come. How we use facilities is changing and will continue to change, but our need for high-quality research and teaching spaces will not change. We must have a predictable source of funding for facility repair and renovation. Now, while the keeper allocation in the bonding bill is the primary source of this funding historically, the fact is that for at least a decade and likely longer, our keeper funding allocations have not been sufficient to meet our needs. Each year that our keeper allocation falls short of our request, we fall behind in facilities repair and maintenance, and we create a larger and more expensive gap over time. To address this challenge, we're proposing a new strategy. This is that the state of Minnesota provide an incremental $5 million in recurring and maintenance operation appropriation to the university for each of 4 years beginning in FY16. In exchange, the University of Minnesota will reduce our HEPA request by $5 million over each of the 4 years. In the end, by providing a predictable and stable source of funding, the university can reduce its long-term facilities costs by addressing crucial issues in a timely manner before they simply become more expensive. Research shows that every dollar of annual stewardship investment is worth $3 to $4 in future unplanned repairs or replacement. Our third goal in this request is to ensure a healthy Minnesota. We are Minnesota's only land-grant university, and we are its most important provider of healthcare professional training and education. We have a clear vision, that is to train, to serve, to discover, and ultimately to cure. And that means doing so as we meet the needs of our state's aging and diverse population, be it in greater Minnesota or in underserved rural and urban communities. We began the session proposing an $11.5 million investment each year in the biennium to advance this strategy. We've adjusted our initial request because of Governor Dayton's action in response to the Special Committee on the Future of the University's Medical School. As you know, last August, the governor formed a Blue Ribbon Commission and charged it with developing recommendations to ensure the medical school's national preeminence by attracting and retaining world-class faculty, staff, students, and residents, sustaining the university's national leadership in healthcare research, innovation, and service delivery, expanding the university's clinical services to strengthen its ability to serve as a statewide resource for providers and patients, and to address the state's health workforce needs to serve Minnesota's broad continuum, including primary care, a growing aging population, and increasing chronic needs. That Blue Ribbon Commission issued a report last month recommending 7 strategies to meet this charge, including investments in research, faculty recruitment, workforce development, and facilities. And in response to those recommendations, Governor Dayton has proposed a $30 million investment in the biennium, for a medical school to hire top researchers as part of medical discovery teams, support clinical research support services, invest in physician training programs that benefit rural communities. And this funding, along with that envisioned by the governor for the next biennium, will allow the medical school to hire 50 new researchers, 8 in 16-17 and 10 per year thereafter. This will help increase NIH grant awards and improve the ranking and reputation of the medical school. So with that governor's investment in mind, we amended our original request by $9 million because clinical research support services are now included in the governor's proposal. Our amended Healthy Minnesota request will now be for a general fund appropriation of $7.5 million in FY16 and $18 million in FY17 for a total biennial cost of $25.5 million. That's an investment in a health professional workforce, new models of promotion and care initiatives. We are, of course, pleased with Governor Dayton's vision for lifting the medical school to greater prominence and the proposed investment. I believe it strengthens our partnership with the state. With your support of the Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendation, we would take immediate and ambitious action to address the state's most critical health care opportunities. Vibrant communities. Finally, with this request, our goal is to promote economic development through 2 targeted initiatives, one focused on statewide industry and one on community vitality. First, We are proposing an investment to promote economic development by preventing and treating environmental problems associated with mineral extraction, or what most of us call mining. Second, we would promote economic development by enhancing community vitality with investments focused on reducing health, educational, and social disparities among Minnesota's diverse and changing communities. To support this critical work, we're proposing for each initiative $1.75 million in the first year and $2.7 million in the second year of the biennium, for a total of $12.5 million. This university has a long and deep history of working with the state's mining and environmental communities to improve technology and protect the environment. In doing so, we also boost the economic vitality of northeastern Minnesota and the Iron Range. Certainly, our University of Minnesota campus, Duluth campus, is critical to that. To advance mining solutions, we'll conduct basic and applied research that encompasses the entire mining lifestyle: development, mining, closure, remediation, long-term monitoring, and stewardship. This research will use microbiological, physical, and chemical methods to treat environmental problems and develop new value-added products using mining waste. Finally, we'll create a public repository of physical specimens and characterization information and data, and this will facilitate increased understanding of the geology, geochemistry, and microbiology of the Duluth complex minerals. It'll coordinate research on ores, waste rocks, and biological specimens, and open transparent communication with the public. This is a plan to bring research results to address current and practical challenges. The singular focus is to improve the economic and environmental sustainability of mineral extraction through applying excellent science and engineering in support of decisions. It is not a plan to develop or study new policies. The second prong of this economic development investment is to strengthen our rural communities by developing research and evidence-based solutions to critical challenges they face. Through our Vibrant Communities strategy, we will bring university expertise and research-based best practices to tackle some of the state's grand challenges, such as the K-12 achievement gap, the need to improve nutrition, and to improve experiences for our immigrant communities. We will target areas of community need in both rural and urban Minnesota to ensure our citizens and the communities in which they live have the skills and resiliency they need to succeed. The initiative will bring together transdisciplinary teams from across the system and engage students in applied research statewide. The outcomes will be powerful. We will help lead the state's approach to mining solutions and will provide access for the full community to data. Through this work, the quality of life statewide will improve. We'll leverage additional external funding, and we can improve the quality and scope of our students' educational opportunities. So to review, we're requesting an increase from our current base for a total of $1.3 billion over the next 2 years. That is a lot of money. But this request simply makes us whole. It only gets us back to the slightly above the level of funding we received in 2008, before the recession, not adjusted for inflation. And that's what this slide and chart reveals. These dollars are not adjusted for inflation. The request by 2017 would get us back to just about where we were nearly a decade earlier. It's what we need to continue to serve our students in the state of Minnesota. It will fund critical investments, including a tuition freeze, a new facilities improvement strategy, a healthy Minnesota, and vibrant communities. In closing, let's take a look at the impact that this budget request will bring. Always being mindful, please, that this request reflects our vision, our ambition, our commitment to the state, and our devotion to our land-grant mission. It means approximately 53,000 students and their family will benefit from a tuition freeze and improved facilities. We will address Minnesota's most acute healthcare workforce shortages, and we will address the achievement gap and other critical community issues. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe our budget request talks volumes about the fiscal responsibility, affordability, and public service commitment of the University of Minnesota. I thank you very much for the opportunity to present this budget to you. I thank you, and I'm eager to answer more of your questions, But before I do that, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Dean Jackson of our medical school and faculty member Lynn Barringer, who will explain the impacts of this request. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, President Kaler. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Brooks Jackson, Dean of the Medical School and Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota.
I'm Lynn Barringer, Professor at the University of Minnesota with appointments in nursing, medicine, and public health.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'd just like to elaborate on the Healthy Minnesota proposal and the governor's budget proposal that came out of the Blue Ribbon Committee's recommendations. First, I think many people know about the Healthy Minnesota proposal, but in essence, this is asking for $25.5 million over the next biennium, and the items in the request fall into several categories. First is, and the biggest, is for money for statewide network of primary care teaching clinics and revamping the curriculum for that. I think this committee did visit our community university healthcare center down in Minneapolis. This is an example of one of those interdisciplinary primary care clinics. I think most people are aware that healthcare delivery models are rapidly changing from hospital-focused, very treatment-oriented, specialist-focused, to more outpatient, interdisciplinary primary care, which is more affordable. It provides better access of, to patients, better coordination of care, and again, more affordable care. This money is requested for preceptors for our students. The Cook Clinic, which many of you saw, does train some 260 medical students and residents per year. We think this is a model that will become much more common in the future, both in urban areas as well as in greater Minnesota, that, again, will provide better care to patients throughout the state. Typically, our money for this type of training for residents and even medical students to some extent has come through to the hospitals as opposed to outpatient settings, certainly not in primary care clinics and in greater Minnesota or underserved urban areas. So this money will allow us to train our, like I said, medical students and residents, fellows, as well as dentists and pharmacists and nurses, so that it really is truly interdisciplinary. So there is better coordination of care, one-stop shopping, so to speak. So we believe this is one of the major areas we will be able to provide more affordable, accessible care in the future with this training. Also in this, the second part of this is money for training for our acute workforce shortage needs. In particular, dentistry is an area where we, in terms of number of dentists per population, is quite low, below the national average. We have 16 counties in the Minnesota in which there is only one dentist, and most of them are in their 60s and close to retirement. So that there is a real shortage there. We need to train more dentists for that. Mental health, psychiatry, shortages in this area. So we can train more psychiatrists, for example, would be an area, as well as other mental health providers. Geriatrics, a third area here. I think everyone on this committee is aware that the number of Minnesotans that will be 65 and older will double by in the next 15 years by 2030. We do not have a specific geriatric training program. And what I mean by geriatrics, this is typically people over 75, 80, and the care of these elderly individuals is really quite different in terms of providing care than say, your 60 to 75-year-olds. And we will see many, many more of these types of patients in Minnesota and want to be able to have the geriatricians to be able to take care of them. As well as there's the workforce diversity. I think everyone is aware that in Minnesota, the diversity of our population is changing quite rapidly, certainly here in the Twin Cities. Our goal is that our healthcare professional workforce should reflect the diversity of our patient population. And so we would like scholarship money and money for pipeline programs where we can take underrepresented minorities in particular to be able to come, for example, these pipeline programs at the university for summer jobs in our laboratories or in clinics to get them involved in healthcare and in developing an interest in that area. The other thing is our good, really excellent underrepresented minority applicants are highly sought after around the country. We have very little scholarship money. We were only able to provide two full scholarships last year, for example, in the medical school. Most of our health sciences do not have that much money for that sort of thing, and so we are competing against Harvard and Hopkins for these students, and this would help us retain them in Minnesota, and hopefully and very most likely they would end up practicing here as well. And then lastly, new models of health promotion and care. There's sort of two items here. One is to pilot new care models of delivery. I talked about, you saw the COOC, but there are other potential models that we're looking at in terms of less, more interprofessional care, maybe at a smaller level than you saw at COOC, but looking at other nursing models of care or pharmacists with medication management in conjunction with nurses would be part of that. We want to evaluate how effective that is. So these would be small pilot projects looking at that. And if successful, we would obviously try to ramp that up. And then lastly, the Minnesota Electronic Health Library. The university spends a lot of money on licenses for our specialty journals and databases, which is accessible to everybody at the university. But this would allow us for a relatively small amount of money to extend those licenses to all healthcare professionals in Minnesota. These are expensive for individual practitioners to be able to get access to on their own, but it would also provide access for all Minnesotans. If you have a Minnesota IP address, which everybody in Minnesota has a distinct Minnesota IP address, would allow you to have access to those journals and those databases. You know, Google is okay, but it doesn't really get you, it's not always reliable, and this really would allow the latest and best information. So that's a relatively good bargain for patient education as well as healthcare professional access to good information. And so I'll move on then to the governor's budget proposal. And as President Kaler mentioned, this $30 million request, most of this is for putting together medical discovery teams where we can hire up to 50 tenure-track faculty who would focus on probably five or six key areas of research that would catapult us as a world-class leader in these areas. These would be defined over the next several months. We want to do this carefully and thoughtfully, but it is likely to be in areas that there is a lot of NIH funding for, as well as other federal types of funding that would ultimately have large impact. It's likely that there will be an area, some area of cancer, could be diabetes, could be vaccine development, healthcare disparities, but we would build on the strengths that we have and the patient populations we serve and work with industry in Minnesota to really have that synergy that we would be most successful in being world-class in these areas. There's also some money in there, as President Kaler mentioned, for our rural physician associate program and metro physician associate program, which it's about $1 million or so, I think, of that 30 that would be used to increase the stipends and the number of slots for medical students who agree to do 9 months of training in a rural area or in an underserved urban area, because we had this program since 1971. About half of those students who do that end up practicing in these areas, which are clearly there are shortages in these areas, but that stipend of $9,000 has been that since 1971, so there's been a lot of inflation since 1971, so we want to increase that and increase the number of slots so we can fill those shortages in these areas. So I think that summarizes the proposal in a little more detail. I do just want to point out that you and your predecessors have invested in the past very heavily, I think, in medical research and in training and education. One of the reasons I came back to Minnesota is because Minnesotans, probably more than any other state, truly value education, has one of the most highly educated populations in the United States. And I think the investments that you've all made in the past have paid off, not only because Minnesotans have probably the longest life expectancy and most affordable care in the country, but our discoveries at the medical school and the academic health sciences have spawned 400 medical device companies in Minnesota, as well as a number of other biotech companies. And I think we want to continue that and remain a leader in these fields. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. Linda Berenger, you're up next.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Nornes and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be able to speak with you about faculty perspectives on the university's budget request. I'm a professor in three schools in the Academic Health Center, an alum of the University of Minnesota. In fact, I trained and worked at the Community University Healthcare Clinic that you visited a few weeks ago. My teaching and my research focuses on the health of young people, how we can raise responsible, resourceful, resilient children, even when the odds are against them. And with colleagues, I've partnered with schools and clinics and public health agencies and after-school programs all around the state. I've taught providers who now work in every kind of clinical setting in Minnesota. But I'm also one of two faculty legislative liaisons, as I described to you when I spoke to your committee a couple weeks ago. Let me turn to the budget request. What does the partnership between the university and the legislature mean to faculty? Why is it important to us? First, this partnership directly translates into our ability to attract high-quality students. In fact, the financing of graduate education is one of the top five priorities identified by the elected leadership of the university's faculty governance. We give attention to many ways to support student costs, scholarships offered through gifts to the university, assistantships on research grants, direct stipend and tuition support through training grants. During the last three decades that I've been at the University of Minnesota, I've written 21 federal grants that have brought in $39 million in support of the university's teaching mission. The vast majority of these dollars have provided tuition and stipend support for students in the health disciplines. This translates into over 300 graduate students who did not have to pay full tuition. It's a critical way that faculty are working to reduce the cost of graduate education to students, but federal grants are not enough. It's tough to recruit, interview, accept top-rate graduate students who show tremendous promise and then lose them to better offers from University of California, University of Michigan. Right now, typically, we can offer, if at all, only 1 year of stipend and tuition support, if that. Many other universities have the capacity to offer 5 years of committed support, and that's the average length of time for completing a doctorate. We want these high-quality students to say yes to Minnesota so that we can train the talented workforce of Minnesota. Let me tell you about two former students of mine. Cindy completed her Doctor of Nursing Practice, or DNP, with a double major, mental health and adolescent health. She's from Esco, Minnesota, near Duluth. And like all of our 340 currently enrolled students in the DNP program, she completed her three-year coursework online, visiting campus twice a semester. We have 134 clinical sites around the state. So Cindy did her practica near home. She now works as a mental health therapist in schools in this rural area and provides direct clinical services to young people as well. Carrie got her PhD in nursing, supported in part by one of our federal training grants. For the past decade and a half, she's been a nursing faculty at St. Ben's in St. Cloud. And now hundreds of former students of hers are working around the state providing health care. That's what the university's budget request means to faculty, tackling the tough issue of the cost of higher education, and specifically the cost borne by students and their families. Our partnership has helped these students and thousands of others succeed. And to the faculty, the budget request also means the ability to recruit and retrain and retain the best scholars and teachers. Simply put, to preserve our stature as a top research and teaching institution, we cannot lose our best and our brightest or our rising stars to other universities. We believe that the priorities in this budget request will help us keep talent here in the state and bring in those with great promise. It's essential to assuring a high-quality healthcare workforce. I could speak to that. In closing, I would also like to speak in support of the request to improve facilities across the coordinate campuses. The average age of buildings on campus, which comprises 29 million square feet, is 92 years of age, or built in 1923. The age of my house, which we have been restoring since we moved in 35 years ago. We can't provide 21st century education in 20th century facilities. The university's request is to create stable resources for planning, improving, and restoring the spaces and places on campus where learning occurs. We have to be able to fix the roof when the sun is shining. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak on behalf of faculty to the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Berenger. Thank you for a comprehensive presentation, and we have a number of questions to follow up your presentation with, beginning with the Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is best for Dr. Jackson or President Kaler, but I'm interested in your medical school investment proposal. And Dr. Jackson, you did mention Minnesota industry. And specifically what I'm interested in is as we expand NIH grant receipts and as we engage in more research and seek a top 20 spot, that doesn't necessarily mean it will translate into Minnesota jobs. If we discover a blockbuster pharmaceutical drug, for example, we're going to get the university a lot of royalties from that potentially, but it's very unlikely that it would be produced in Minnesota or that any of the kind of follow-on job creation would happen in Minnesota, whereas if it was a medical device, there's a good chance that much of that would land in Minnesota industry and help Minnesota jobs. So my question is whether your proposal includes any incentive for faculty research to focus on research areas that would actually spur innovation and job growth for industries that are in Minnesota in the same way that, for example, the mining proposal would do for an existing Minnesota industry.
President Kaler, Dr. Jackson, or
thank you, Chair Norris, Representative Winkler. Let me take a stab at that. And if I might indulge before that, I was remiss in my introductory remarks to not acknowledge the beneficiaries of the University of Minnesota. We have a group of students with us this afternoon, and if you'd like to be inspired after the committee meeting, I'd suggest a conversation with one or all of them. Representative Winkler, great question. I mentioned that we started 15 startup companies last year alone. We have been working with great focus on building our ability to translate research discoveries into business, which is how you deliver them for the good of people. Our Vice President for Research, Brian Herman, has now a national reputation for the innovations that we've created. We've created something called the Minnesota Innovation Partnership, or MIN-IP, which, briefly put, streamlines our negotiation with companies for royalty rights and enables us to do that kind of translation of research into companies. We've done a variety of other things, including putting university resources into funding and very early stage inventions. We had a roundtable where we highlighted university inventions for local angel investors. And at least two of those off the top of my head were actually drug discovery candidate, lead candidates, so we're doing that sort of pharmaceutical research as well. In the College of Pharmacy, we have a substantial drug discovery laboratory that has pilot plant scale equipment, so we can actually produce the amount of materials that would be needed for clinical trials in Minnesota. So we're building an infrastructure there to over a period of time, hopefully rival the medical device industry, but we're very attentive to the concern you raised, which is a real one, which is to make it here and have it develop somewhere else. So we're working hard to make sure that we have the infrastructure to enable that not to be true.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, just a follow-up then. I read maybe last summer about interesting research taking place at the St. Anthony Falls in collaboration with a company trying to develop tidal power, I think, in maybe New York Harbor or something like that, or the Hudson. I can't remember where it was. And I read that, and I thought, well, it's fascinating research. I'm glad we have the facilities. But again, it's research that is going to lead to industrial applications outside of Minnesota, which, you know, I'm not saying we should never do that. Of course, that's going to happen. But the question that I was asking was more about the incentives. Faculty-driven research is based on faculty members' ability to their interest level in certain areas, their experience, and their drive to find NIH or other sources of funding. Question is, do we have incentives in place for those faculty members to actually seek research that is tied to local industry? Because building a pharma industry from scratch here is going to be a little bit beyond your power at the university. There aren't very many people here who even know how to do that. So are there incentives internally to get faculty members focused on solving problems for Minnesota businesses?
Absolutely. Kaler? Absolutely. Chair Nornes, Representative Winkler. I can't think of any better example of a structure that does that than the MnDrive initiative that you funded in the last biennium. The four areas there, food, water, neuromodulation, and robotics, exactly create that research incentive for somebody to say, you know, I could apply what I'm doing to a water problem or a robotics problem, and I'm going to do that. And in each of those areas, we have very strong connection with local Minnesota companies, which in many cases are multinational companies because of the innovation culture in Minnesota, and industrial advisory committees and a variety of connections. So MnDrive really has as a corollary benefit, I think, exactly what you're looking at. And if I could come back to the St. Anthony Falls story, that's a great example of our ability to be entrepreneurial with a resource that we have, the Mississippi River and the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory, and go out and find somebody who's going to come and pay us to use that facility and pay our researchers to do work.
Representative Winkler.
Finally, Mr. Chair, then, Dr. Kaler, I remember that story from MnDrive and that kind of priority. I guess the question is, why not make that the budget request to increase funding for that? Is there no more money that would be helpful there, or is that model something that you've tapped out, or did the governor kind of steal your thunder on the medical school and kind of drive it that direction? I like the MnDrive model, and it seems like that would be a place that legislators would be excited to fund.
So, Chair Nornes, Representative Winkler, you're now forcing me to tip my hand for next biennium's request. We thought carefully about that. And right now we have a good story to tell about the impact MnDrive has had, but we haven't had time to actually make it a truly knock-your-socks-off story. This time, 2 years from now, we will attempt to knock your socks off with why an investment like MnDrive is a terrifically good idea.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, you're next.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, President Kaler, and thanks for all the good work you do at the University of Minnesota. That benefits all of us as citizens and people who are in our nation and across the world. That's the last compliment I'll give you, by the way. No. Just kidding. Couple concerns from last session that had come up that I'd like you to address. I appreciate your commitment to the reduction of $90 million over 6 years. But, you know, back to the Wall Street Journal article a little bit, and also in talking to some of the regent candidates, you know, one of the concerns was that the use of titles to increase compensation packages and administrative costs at the university, and in talking with some of the region candidates, they think progress has been made, but there's still a lot to do in that area. And again, the Wall Street Journal article kind of highlighted that a few years ago, and it was a concern from last session. Just wanted to see what your perspective was on that as far as solutions, and to what degree did you address it in the $90 million savings?
President Kaler.
Chair Norness, Representative Gernhagen. Thank you for that question. We are $36 million towards our $90 million target. One of the things, one of the many, many things we've done is to actually, and this is a little nitty-gritty, but it's a nitty-gritty question, if you will, create a modern HR system that has system-wide consistent job families, so that we've eliminated this catch-all area, which was called coordinator or director, and professionalized the titles and identified them in job families so that people know where they fit. We do have people who do administrative work. If we have a research grant that requires somebody to report progress to the federal government, you know, we hire somebody to do that. That's just part of the deal. But that sort of title and title creep is now under control, and it does help us identify job responsibilities that allow us then to begin to do a so-called spans and layers approach. Again, in consultation with national experts on what an organization should look like. And what I mean by that is right-sizing the number of employees that report to a supervisor. You don't want to have a supervisor supervise one person, and you don't want to have them supervise 50 people, because neither one of those limits is the right thing. So we are making pretty dramatic changes in how the university is organized, and as a consequence, we've been able to find resources to move from administrative to mission delivery and mission support activities.
Representative Gunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your response. So my understanding from your response is progress has been made, and it will probably continue to be made.
Chair Norness, Representative Gruenhagen, it will not probably continue to be made. It will continue to be made, okay, until we reach $90 million, and we'll probably keep going.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, I have just a few more questions. The other concern that was brought up last session was the differentiation between foreign student tuition versus Minnesota tuition students, and that in some cases I had emails of complaints from parents that their student was being passed over for admission, if memory serves me, in favor of out-of-state or foreign students. Has that tuition difference comparatively to other major institutions been addressed in this past year?
President Kaler.
Chair Norness, Representative Gruenhagen. It has been addressed in the sense that we have increased the out-of-state tuition, but our peers have increased it too. So I am not yet satisfied with the level of out-of-state tuition. I actually agree philosophically with the fact that out-of-state students should pay, if not their complete, it certainly is a very substantial share of the cost of education. But we find ourselves in an interesting dilemma. And that has to do, frankly, with the price sensitivity of higher education. So we've been able over the past decade to build a pretty good pipeline of students from out of state who come, excuse me, to Minnesota. But we're worried about the impact the yield would be on students who faced an enormously increased out of state tuition bill. So we've done some modeling on that. We will continue to increase our out-of-state tuition at a healthy rate. But, you know, to do the numbers, if you have, from a revenue point of view, if you increase the tuition 10% and you lose 20% of your students, you actually lose money on the deal. But I am sensitive to it. It's been mentioned by others of your colleagues to me as well. On your second point of a in-state student being passed over for an out-of-state student, we evaluate in-state and out-of-state students by the same metric. So if they're qualified, we will offer them admission. We don't put our thumb on the scale if it's an out-of-state student.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response, President Kaler. The next question is for Dr. Kaler. Previously on the HHS finance, we've been told that we're, I can't remember the number of years, we're going to have a 600 doctor shortage in, I think, the rural area. I can't remember if it was 5 or 10 years. And 1,200 within, you know, let's just say 600 shortage in 5 years, 1,200 in 10 years. It was something like that. I might be off a little bit on those years. But do you believe this investment that you're requesting, and you have touched on it in your testimony, will go a long ways towards addressing that shortage in the rural area where access to medical care is becoming critical in some areas?
Are you addressing that to Dr. Jackson?
Jackson,
Dr. Taylor. Okay. Dr. Jackson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenhagen, I do. I certainly do think this request will certainly allow us to address and correct these shortages. I strongly believe that. I think it's going to be a mixture of incentives as well as new care delivery models that will do this. I don't think it's any one piece of this, but all of it together will certainly allow us to make a lot of headway in this area. I certainly do think we could do this over 5-7 years. I mean, obviously training takes time, but if we start now, typical healthcare professional, whether it's a doctor or a nurse, I mean, we're looking at anywhere from probably 4 to 7 years, depending on the type of health professional. So I do think we will be able to do that, as well as the types of students we take in terms of their interests. Clearly, if, for example, in Duluth, we strongly select student applicants who have a real interest in rural health, for example. I think 85% of our students are typically from towns of Minnesota of less than 20,000 people. I mean, all of these different things really help to make a difference, and we will continue to do that. And as I said, with some of these incentives, with the governor's proposal with the Rural Physician Associate Program, for example, I think if those stipends can increase in the number of slots, I think we will be able to do that.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple more quick questions.
We have about 7 on our list here,
okay,
so we need to move
right
quite along. So.
On the facility improvement, is that money in a separate silo, President Kaler, or is it can it be drained off for other projects?
Chair Nornes, Representative Gruenhagen, we have desperate need for this money, so it would be very difficult for it to go somewhere else, and we would keep it in a separate budget and would account for it separately should the state request that.
Okay. Representative Norton, are you finished?
Just two more quick comments, no questions.
Okay, make them
quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, you know, I'm on the agricultural finance, and I hope there's some type of desire to emphasize agricultural education at the U that's been decreasing according to the testimony we've seen there, and I think we have a proposal to try to increase that. And also, I really appreciate your investments in mining and solutions, and if you do a great job in that area, maybe we can eliminate the MPCA and the PUC, and I'll split the difference on the savings and half to you and put a half in the general fund. Okay? Thank you.
Representative Norton, you've been waiting patiently.
Well, not very patient.
Okay.
Thank you. I want to get to the research issue, which I probably talk about. I maybe just expect it. But I have been very supportive over the years for the U doing research, and it's one of the great things about our university. So I have two questions. One's kind of a about NIH, and the other is more philosophical. So you've talked about hiring 50 top researchers and having these teams, and that sounds like a fabulous opportunity. But I also know in talking with you and others in research that the NIH grants at the federal level are shrinking and there will be less money available. So I'm a little concerned about the timing of increasing 50 new staff people at a time when federal funds are less. So that's going to be my first kind of more specific question. But the second part is philosophical. And in this body this year alone, and I've come to you in the past for Genomics Partnership, and I've supported the regenerative medicine. You do lots of your own great research. But we have proposals before us in various committees on Alzheimer's research, on spinal cord injury research, on disease-specific research. And I've spent a lot of time in the last few weeks talking to folks out in the research world about the state's role in doing this. And is our role to fund our university public institution by giving you open-ended amounts of money and letting you choose when these great folks come to us with compelling stories about why spinal cord injury or Alzheimer's needs to be, you know, raised in importance? Do we give money to outside entities to do research, which we're being asked to do, or do we give money to you, our land-grant university and research institution, with a specific request that you study Alzheimer's and many of the other disease-specific requests that we're seeing before us? Because, frankly, looking at these folks with very compelling stories and saying, we're not going to fund you is really hard to do. And yet, you are our research institution, and they're coming to us for money. And so those are the two issues, the NIH funding and its decrease at the time you're adding 50, and then this other piece.
Are you directing that to President Kaler? Whomever.
Whomever. Chair Nornes, Representative Norton, those are great questions. I'll answer the second one as best I can and ask my subject matter expert to talk about the NIH. That is a great question, and I, too, have been visited by people with compelling stories in need of research. Our approach on this is to build a broad-based research enterprise to hire top-ranked faculty and let them work on what they want to work on, which is at the intersection usually of a scientific opportunity and a funding source. And not all diseases are in that space. So they're particularly rare diseases for which it's very difficult to get the kind of money needed to do research. Those are often funded privately. They may have their own philanthropy associated with them. We do terrific work on a couple of childhood diseases that are just awful. That are funded privately. We are responsive to legislative requests for research in specific area, for which last session was an example is the regenerative medicine. We do work to balance members' requests with the overall responsibility of the regents to manage the university, and so we have a way to fold that into our budget process. There could be a situation that emerges in which a patient group or a member may make a request for us to do research and give us a dollar, and we would need $10 to make anything resembling progress, and so we would have a discussion about how that dollar could be better used. So all of those are out there. I guess I'd come back to where I started, that at the university we use state dollars to build this research foundation and find opportunities that our research scientists think will have the best return on the investment of their career in the dollars that are provided by sponsors towards that cure. So with respect to the NIH, perhaps Dr. Jackson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton. So I think it is true, NIH funding has been flat, and in terms of real terms, it has decreased and has become more competitive. However, the way we design this request and these medical discovery teams, I think we will be successful at obtaining increased NIH funding for the following reasons. One, more NIH funding is becoming team-based. The idea that individual researchers are going to be able to get what we call the R01 funded, investigator-initiated, is going to be much more difficult. And as NIH moves towards team-based science approaches, these teams will be in a much better position working together as a team to get those NIH funds. Secondly, the people, the faculty we recruit here will already be NIH funded. So that in itself will increase the NIH funding. The idea is so that they will, if they have one NIH grant, we as a team, we believe that they will be able to get two and these program project grants and bigger grants, which is what NIH is funding, these big team-based type grant awards. So I do think we will be able to do that. I should also say, Congress, the President of the United States, they are considering increasing the NIH budget this year, I believe, by 3.3%, by $1 billion. So, things may change a little bit with the NIH budget, but even if it stays flat, I think we will be in a more competitive position with this proposal to be able to obtain that. And just to address the issue about, disease-specific requests, you know, these areas we're looking at will probably be broader based. So, for example, I do anticipate, because there's so much morbidity with neurological diseases, particularly neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, traumatic brain injury, many of which there are common mechanisms for degeneration involved with this. So, you know, I think the broader the area that can cover more areas like regenerative medicine, it doesn't just involve hematologic diseases. It potentially can be applied across many diseases. And I sort of personally favor that approach as opposed to specific diseases. Of course, I'm always supportive of any money for medical research. But I think that is likely to yield a better return on the investment and allows you to move the money where, you know, science never is a linear path. I mean, it goes all over the place. So you want to be able to have that flexibility. And I think if it's targeted more towards a broader area than as opposed to a specific disease, I think it's better return on the investment.
Ms. Berenger, you had something you wanted to add?
Yes, Chair Nornes and Representative Norton. Why investment in university research? And I'd like to just point out from a faculty's perspective, I've been NIH funded as well as the training grants I mentioned earlier. And when we bring research dollars into the university, it creates tremendous opportunity for teaching, and teaching at the highest levels of the training the scholars that are going to carry on. And I think that in like every other tenured faculty in the Academic Health Center, we have to advance our research programs at the same time as being excellent in our teaching. And the time is short, like all positions. And I have found that the best way to be efficient is to create great synergy between the teaching and the research. With colleagues, we've done research with all sorts of populations of people in all sorts of neighborhoods in the Twin Cities and around the state. And that research attracts certain types of students. So among the students in my field that we've trained over the last 25, 30 years, one quarter of them are from racial, ethnic, underrepresented minority groups. And I think that's critical. It's because they're attracted because they see us doing research in this area. So I think that really speaks to why invest in research at the university, because it also advances the teaching mission.
Vice Chair O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So thank you for coming today, everybody. And President Kaler, I just wanted to talk just a few minutes about the DAU's achievement in meeting all five of the metrics for the 5% holdback. And specifically, if you could comment a little bit about maybe which one of those was most difficult to achieve, and just give a little brief comment there. And then also more specifically, what did the U actually do to increase undergrad STEM degrees?
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Vice Chair O'Neill. I think The prediction of graduation rates is something that can be done pretty accurately, because if you know how many juniors you have this year, you can make a pretty good guess of how many of them are going to graduate next year. So those are tracking. And those were a consequence of really a decade long, perhaps longer, focus driven by the Board of Regents and setting ambitious graduation rates, and just relentless work by faculty, and by some dreaded administrators called advisors, to guide students into a channel to success in a time period. So those were the consequence of decades of work. The STEM field ones, again, are simply a commitment to increasing the enrollment in STEM fields. I've lost track of my years, so let me say 3 years ago, I made a commitment to increase by 1,000 enrollment in STEM disciplines, as well as nursing, to meet workforce needs. Those young people are incredibly valuable to our Minnesota industry, and so that the output of that increases is there. In the STEM fields, in particular, our College of Science and Engineering There's remarkable demand, qualified students, for which we do not have enough space. We're particularly limited in facilities, but also in faculty members in those fields. So there's a limited amount more we can do there without a pretty dramatic investment. Ironically, I think the one that I worried about the most, because I wanted desperately to meet all five, were the invention disclosures. I joked, and please don't take this seriously, that I could invent something and disclose it if it became necessary, but fortunately I didn't have to do that. That was one that is difficult to predict. It relies on the serendipity of discovery, and that was the hardest.
Thank you. Okay, next on the list, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the U of M for being here today, especially President Kaler. I appreciate your candor when you come, and when I talk to you, you're always open to ideas and thoughts on how to improve the U of M. I do have a couple questions related, getting back maybe to the issue of the budget and what your budget request is. If you could turn, I'm a little bit confused about one slide on your budget, and that's page 9, slide 17, where you're... I think this is your summary of your budget request, in which you are asking for $42.5 million in 2016, $63.2 million in 2017, which should equal $105.7, but then right below there where you have the arrow, if you're there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Looks like your total biennium request is $148.2. I'm not sure what your request is. Is it $105.7? Or 148.2. Maybe I'm looking at this incorrectly, but there seems to be confusing numbers here.
President Kaler?
Chair Nornes, Representative Barnett, I'm going to give you an answer, and then I'm going to turn to my CFO, who's sitting behind me, and he will either nod or he will come to the microphone and correct me. So one of those things will happen. We are requesting 148.2. So the biennial math is 42.5 in 16. Then we want that 42.5 in 17 plus another 63.2. And so the biennial would be 42 in 16, 105 in 17 for a total over the biennium of 148.2.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. So then, thank you, Mr. Chair, and President Kaler. You know, as I've been doing some research on the University of Minnesota and just trying to understand your budget request and what it would be used for and kind of the history of tuition and costs at the U of M, I'm finding that I'm having more respect for you every day, and that's because of all the things you do at the U of M. You know, a lot of people just think you're educating kids, not that that's a just thing, but it's one of many things that you're involved in. We've kind of touched on that today, but you look at your budget, you got a pretty big budget, you know, $3.3 billion a year, of which the expenses are in many, many areas, instruction being one. Looking through your financial statement, you have instruction, you have research, you have public service, academic support, student services, institutional support, operations, scholarships, depreciation, all, and it goes on and on. So regarding the plan you have, of which you're somewhat on your way to the goal of $90 million reduction in costs, where would I find that? If I were to look for that $36 million that you've achieved right now, where would I find that in your financial statement?
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Barrett. Let me now call my friend, the Chief Financial Officer, to the table, if you will. While he's coming, I'll provide my answer of that. The sheet you are looking at requires us to classify dollars and activity in certain categories. For us to be able to dig into the marbled meat of the university and identify administrative activities at a unit level and then pull those out and redirect those dollars requires us to keep track of each individual activity that we do that contributes to that. Those then would roll up into the consolidated financials, but not in a way that makes it obvious of what we've done. So we keep a detailed list, and we can easily provide that to you, of each of the administrative cuts that we've made and each of the process savings in administration that we've done and that have been audited, and we'd be happy to provide that to you. But I do agree it's difficult to see that clearly in the what I believe are the financial analyses you're looking at.
Mr. Fritzenreiter, do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Fritzenreiter. I go by Fitz. I'm the CFO and treasurer at the university. It's important to understand that what's going on, and there was a letter provided to the commissioner of MMB, of which there was copied to the chairs of the higher ed committee, and we'll be happy to make that available to all of you, that was itemized in our performance measures. For example, the target was $15 million reallocation. There's an itemization in that letter that shows you position by position, item by item, of the reductions that were made. I'll give you an example of how it works. In my case, I recently, in my office, I had a person who did my help desk for my office. One person served about 8 people. In the course of a budget cut that my office was given, I have to eliminate a position because I was told I have to cut for part of that $15 million. That position gets eliminated because we made a decision to consolidate help desk support so that it's not one person supporting 8 people in my office, but today we're about one person supporting 130 on our way to trying to have one person supporting 190 people. That position gets eliminated, and that money gets reallocated to pay for another expense in the institution. So the money's in the financial statements, but it's been repurposed for a different expense.
Representative Barrett.
Just a quick follow-up to that. I hate to call you Fitz because it seems so informal, but I don't remember your last name.
You know, it's like Cher, Prince.
All right. So why hasn't that money been redistributed to lower tuition or freeze tuition at the U of M?
Who wants to take that? Dr. Jackson?
Can I just comment? So we went through the same process last year. The medical school was not a beneficiary of the tuition freeze. That was undergraduate. So we went through this process and through attrition eliminated some positions, and that money was applied to keep tuition flat for this past year. So we took that money and kept tuition flat for the medical school. We were not a part of the undergraduate tuition freeze in the last biennium. So that's exactly what we did.
And then
Representative Barrett,
if I may, Representative Barrett, Chair Nornes, you asked why we didn't use that money to lower tuition, and the answer is we could have. But then we have what we believe are important opportunities that return tremendous value to the state of Minnesota, as are outlined in our budget request here, which means we would have come back to you to ask for an additional $15 million allocation to do this. And let me put this in another way. The budget gap that we are closing at the university is not completely closed by, if you don't do any of the new things, by the tuition freeze dollars. There is more than that we do by internal reallocation to deliver on our multiple missions.
Representative Barrett.
So then a follow-up to that question. One of your major cost areas is institutional support. I don't know quite what that is, but I know it's a heavy salary area. I'm guessing it has some overhead applications to it because of the use of the word support. It's not related to academic support because you have a different line item called academic support. But that area from 2013 to 2014, at a time in which you received a substantial increase in state appropriations, increased from $197 million to $257 million. That's a pretty large increase. And so maybe you could comment on why that would increase in such a high level at the same time you received a high appropriation to freeze tuition at the U of M.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Barrett, I'm sorry we missed our noon meeting yesterday, but I think we're getting rescheduled so we can do a deep dive on that. But just an example. You know, when you go to financial statements, there are a lot. I'm not an accountant, fortunately, so I don't want to beat up on the accountants, but you have to be a little careful because there are a lot of accounting entries in the various function codes at the university, and institutional support in particular is a place where We have to follow these standard rules for the whole country. Anybody that gets federal money has to follow certain definitions and reporting. But inside that institutional support, for example, is where the university books its liability for post-employment retirement benefits, or it's accounting for the fringe benefits costs of the institution. So institutional support of all of those function codes is a potpourri of a lot of different expenses, and it has a lot of variability to it year over year.
Representative Barrett?
If I can, one other question.
Sure.
So back to the issue of tuition, and you know, my goal, you know, as I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, you had a, I think your student senate was here, and I said to them, I asked them, you know, you've been talking about flat tuition. It would seem like a better goal would be to decrease tuition at the U of M, and, you know, they all got a big smile on their face. I was happy to hear that or see that from them, because I think they kind of intuitively agreed that, you know, tuition is too high, and it's a lot of families and school U of M students are struggling to pay their tuition. And so I'm looking at tuition. I'm noticing kind of in the past, and so I think tuition should be reduced. That's my goal. And I would hope at the end of the day, May 20th, whenever we adjourn, there's money appropriated so that the U of M can reduce tuition for their students. And I point to two examples from U of M's history where that backs up my assertion. And that's back in 2011 when Representative Grunhagen mentioned, kind of mentioned this, where you guys actually reduced tuition for non-resident kids by $6,000. You went from $22,700 to $16,650 in one fell swoop. And that was at a time where you received fewer appropriations than the year before. So that happened. That's number one. Number two is your slide, President Kaler, on the same page as the other slide I was looking at, your state appropriation trends from 2006 to 2017. Your high water mark was in 2008. But the tuition increased at the U of M in 2007. It increased from 8563 to 8950. And then that 8950 in 2007 went up to 9600 at the same time your state appropriations increased. And as state appropriations declined, the tuition really didn't seem to do much more than increase a little bit more. So in those cases, state appropriations were not related to tuition. And given that, I think given what you were able to do in the past, now if you received a little bit more money, I would think that tuition could actually decline rather than stay flat. Could you comment on that for me?
President Kaler.
Sure, Chair Norris, Representative Barrett. A lot of things in that question. So let me address a couple. One is with respect to the out-of-state tuition. My understanding was that that occurred in 2008, and I started in 2011, so I didn't make that decision. My understanding was that it was made because the number of out-of-state students that we were attracting at that period in time was very small. There are really good reasons to bring out-of-state students to Minnesota. We're a talent magnet. If you come from outside Minnesota and are educated here, you tend to stay, you tend to find your spouse here, you tend to build a family and a career and a business and a tax base in Minnesota. So I support the idea that we attract out-of-state students, and clearly the price point was viewed as too high given where we were as an institution. It dropped, and now that we've built the pipeline as a result of that drop, we now feel that we can appropriately, prudently move that out-of-state tuition up. So Mr. Fitzenreuter can correct me if I'm wrong on my history, but I think that was the thinking. The other thing that I will tell you is that my philosophy on tuition is about making the university as affordable and accessible for the best students in Minnesota as we can possibly be. My philosophy is to control tuition and not look at tuition as a relief valve. We have laid down a proposal here that I think prudently balances our budget, and we're choosing to ask the state of Minnesota to fund that part rather than increase tuition. If you and your colleagues want to fund more than that, we certainly can consider a recommendation to the regions to lower tuition.
I don't want to cut you off, Representative Barrett. We've got About 22 minutes and then the lights go out?
Sounds good. We don't want the lights to go out, so okay. I'll pass and maybe add me to the end.
We have a long list of people who want to ask questions here. So President Kaler, and you're a hit. I can tell you that. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I have a question about the graph on slide 9 showing the comparing the state investment and the tuition revenue since 1997. And my question is, what would the graph look like if we went back further than 1997? Are the late 90s something of a high watermark in state appropriations? That's essentially my question, is what would it look like if we went back further than 1997?
President Kaler?
Chair Nornes, Representative Christensen, the most honest answer I can give you is that we'll have to look, but I will tell you if you go back to 1950, the state paid a large share of the cost.
Representative Christensen?
Thank you, and then another question I have is, could you talk about some of the ways you've been making progress towards the $90 billion in administrative cuts? You know, what areas or how have you been making those cuts? You know, through layoffs or how have you been doing that?
President Kaler.
Sure. Chair Nornes, members of the committee, Representative Christensen, in the interest of the time, I'll be brief and just give you a few examples. We will give you a detailed list. For example, we used to have four people whose job it was essentially to answer the phone if you dialed zero at the University of Minnesota. We don't need those services anymore, so we separated a group, I believe the number was 21 individuals from our IT department. That creates an opportunity. Those dollars were reinvested in technology for education so that our online and in-classroom efforts could be more technologically sound. We eliminated Fitzmith mentioned the help desk. We're in a multi-year process of removing people whose job it is to help you with IT in your office into a much smaller consolidated pool. Those people either separate from the university as a part of that process or are redeployed into other openings. And the list goes on. So let me just, if you would not mind, I defer in the interest of time and give you the written list.
Thank you.
Representative Christensen. Okay. Moving on to Representative Bernardo. You've been waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Very patiently. So thank you for being here today. And I, I'm a University of Minnesota graduate, very proud of that. So thank you for that opportunity that you give for students here in the state. My husband is as well. My question is on a little bit on the lines of Representative Winkler and Representative Norton. Representative Winkler talked about basic research and healthy Minnesota companies and maybe new startups. Representative Norton talked about the issues that come before the Capitol and how do we solve those, and maybe with partnership or however that we can best move forward as a legislature. My question for you is, how do we partner with University of Minnesota, or how do you partner with us as state government, so our executive branch, as legislators? We do, I mean, the biggest difference we can make in prevention as well as solving problems is policy, system, and environmental changes. And we're making those decisions all the time, whether our state government has to address the Olmstead Act and how they're really going to integrate people fully into the public without going into institutions, and our MnDOT system. We really need to have a really good system. It's not just about money. Our EPA, we spend a lot of dollars on bonding, you know, sewer infrastructure, all different kinds of things. So my question for you is, how can we strengthen that so we actually move research to practice, and how do we create those bridges intentionally? I know I just want to comment. I do want to give a shout out to Dr. Tracy Toomey from the Public Health. She's done a lot in the area of underage access to alcohol. Gene Forrester did a lot of the beginnings of tobacco, underage tobacco use, probably in the country, my guess is, and same with Dr. Toomey. And then Diane Newmark Steiner, she's doing a lot with childhood obesity. And then also with the College of Design, with Mary Vogel, with doing a lot of mapping work. And I just wanted to give a shout out to for the youth spatial Symposium and for allowing practitioners to be able to get free GIS training, which is just amazing. So I want to figure out how we do that more and help us legislators put together the best policies we can so that when they get implemented, they're really going to make a difference in the state, and they're evidence-based and research-based.
President Keeler.
Chair Nornes, Madam Representative, the I just wish we could do this better because we do so much of it, but it's frequently relationship-based or ad hoc, whether it's the traffic center, Center for Transportation Studies, I'm sorry, they have a bigger name than that. Ability to look at what needs to be done with MnDOT. They have a great relationship like this. Our ability to translate our research-based outcomes in closing the K-12 achievement gap, opportunity gap, it's enormously effective interaction between people in the College of Education and Human Development and the Generation Next activity that's taking place in the Twin Cities. But we need to do more of that. So what I would hope you and your colleagues would do is when you see those policy questions or implementation questions or practical application questions, that you would reach out to our government relations folks, and we can then put you in touch with the subject matter experts. You should view us as the greatest research resource that you have, and I wish you'd use it more, and I'd like to find ways to make sure we don't have barriers.
Ms. Barringer?
Yes, Chair Nornes and Representative Bernardi. I spoke with this group a couple of weeks ago, and I gave a couple of examples. In my role and with Gary Gardner, the other faculty legislative liaison, we scan all of the items before your committees on a daily basis. We are not part of the administration. We're faculty. We're given some course release to be in this role. And Diane Newmark Steiner, by the way, was one of the postdocs in my fellowship program. And we work to make that connection, to be that conduit between what faculty are doing and the issues that are coming before you. So I believe it was last week that faculty members from my school, from the medical school, and public health spoke on aspects of aging before I think it was the Health and Human Services Committee. We want to make that connection and make that a reality. Last year, Rebecca Schlafer, who's we're moving into a tenure-track position in the Department of Pediatrics, former fellow in our program, worked with Senator Bonoff's committee in moving forward the legislation around pregnant and parenting incarcerated women. Mm-hmm. We worked faculty in our program worked with Senator Dibble to move forward the legislation around bullying. So those are two examples specifically in related to my area, but I think that is very much a part of the role that I hope you call upon us for.
And Mr. Chair, Bernardi. We actually might want to formalize it for researchers who and professors who are willing to be a resource to us. That might be very, very helpful. And I see a lot of challenges, just to mention, with, you know, I know there might be a good relationship with that Center for Transportation Studies and MnDOT, but there's huge challenges in our state about transportation. And I don't believe it's just about dollars. I believe it's about how we're doing our transportation system, so helping solve some of those questions would be very helpful. And one of the things I think would also be helpful is sharing your experience and, you know, reducing management positions and administration into mission delivery and support activities. I really liked hearing that. We need help in state government doing that. And there's agencies in which I actually want very focus on, and we might be able to learn from you what you all did so that we can make sure that, for example, our Minnesota Department of Transportation as efficient and effective as possible in delivering the mission that they're called to do.
Is that a question?
Yeah.
President Kaler.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. Madam Representative, we would love to do that. I think the best practices we learn here are really very good, and you know, coming some distance from the Wall Street Journal article that I was hoping not to have discussed today, to where we are now, I am very proud of the administrative effectiveness at the University of Minnesota. And as this story gets out and we become more of a national model, we will, I think, more than recoup that reputation. And we're eager to partner with agencies. In fact, we just sent a team of our IT professionals to the Minneapolis Public Schools to help them organize their IT efforts and leadership. So we're eager to be a resource there.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I noticed that the regions and the university made an adjustment for the governor's budget and increased your budget, or at least accommodated the governor's request on the medical school. The governor had another part of his budget dealing with tuition freeze, where he recommended we pay for half and that the university paid for half. Can you tell me where that adjustment is in your presentation?
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pawlowski, we did not make that adjustment because the number we are requesting is what we need to enable there to be no tuition increase. The governor's mark is half of that. We believe that we know that this is the amount of money we need to freeze tuition completely.
Well, Mr. Chair, President Kaler, I'm looking again at the very first slide where you're reducing administrative costs, and apparently none of those reductions, even though by the end they may total $90 million, and they've totaled $36 million, which is not articulated here as to exactly where the $36 million came from or where it went. Wouldn't there be an appropriation from that amount that could go toward tuition? I mean, why, if you're really saving something, couldn't you apply it to tuition costs?
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pawlowski, it is our request to the state to fund the elements that are in our proposal. The cost reductions that we have taken out of administrative costs have been reinvested in elements that we think are of better and higher value. If we were to take that $15 million and put it towards a tuition element, then we would be forced to ask you for a larger appropriation to fund the other things that we think drive real value to the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, maybe I missed something, but when you, and I agree with you, when you rank ordered your budget, I thought tuition and freezing tuition was your number one priority. I mean, you have priorities above that?
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Pawlowski. We do a lot of things at the University of Minnesota. We think all of them are valuable. And at this point in time, we are requesting this amount of support from the state to continue those very valuable operations, and in doing so, not asking our families and their students for a tuition increase. So there are lots of things that we think are valuable and deserve this investment. So we're not all about making tuition as low as possible at the sacrifice of other valuable things that we do.
Well, Mr. Chair, President Kaler, we have another name for what's happening here with the so-called reduction of administration cost. It's called a shift, and you're shifting money from one place to another. Maybe you can do a presentation on where it comes from and then where it's going. That would be a higher priority to your number one priority in your budget, that is tuition and debt. I would hope that at some point we'd get that. Now, what I also didn't see in your budget overview was the reserve. In 2013, you made a presentation on the reserves of the university, and I see Fitz and Reiter is coming to sit down. Will we see a presentation at some point on the reserves of the University of Minnesota and the change in those reserves from the presentation you made in 2013 to 2015?
Mr. Fitz and Reiter?
Representative Pawlowski, we can provide that information to you. I don't know if we have it on a piece of paper right now. But again, the reserves of the university are an important element of how we operate. We have a AA1 credit rating that requires a certain number of days cash on hand to maintain that credit rating, which we use to lower, obviously, the interest payments on bonds that we issue. That money is across the institution and being reserved for important future investments and other activities. So it would not be responsible financial management for us to liquidate reserves.
Representative Pawlowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, President Kaler, I think we disagree on this. We disagreed in 2013. I disagree now. The amount that you had in 2013 was over $900 million, I assume, with the market and with the tuition investments that have been made by students, it's probably higher. But if we can't articulate what you're actually saving and where it's going, how can it possibly be a cost savings to anybody? And why wouldn't the University of Minnesota, if Governor Dayton has said that he thinks you can also make an investment in your number one priority item, I would hope I would be able to see that the university would be able to do that, that there would be real cost savings and that we would see those cost savings realized in the burden that is carried by the students. That you don't need to respond to that. We can have a further conversation, and I think we will, as the session proceeds. And Mr. Fitzenreiter, that's okay. I think I know what you're going to say, but we can save that, too, when we have the presentation on the budget reserves.
All right. We have others that wanted to ask questions. We're not quite done yet. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, unfortunately, I have an eight-part question that I wanted to ask that I'm now going to spare you. Out of deference to many of the people here, but I'm going to maybe address just a couple moments of this and then ask you to get back to me at that. I'm really concerned that as the university does its tightening up and we look at the cuts in administration at the same time trying to bring the university along and maintain its good status, that we're not bringing all parts of the university along equally. And my concern is talking a little bit more about some of our frontline staff. And what we're doing with them, and I've got some concerns that I want to have addressed by you guys at some point regarding how we're looking at the use of our region scholarships and whether or not we're going to bring those back to where they were, how we're looking at the discrepancy in sick paid or professional administrative leave between different types of staffing. I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about how people are able to change jobs and the kind of obstacles they might have in changing jobs and how that might deter them from changing jobs within the U itself. I think there's many parts that I'm very interested in hearing a more concrete answer on, because in my opinion, having been both a student and taught at the U, there is absolutely nothing that would get done if it wasn't for that staff making everything work smoothly. And it would be a shame to me if I were to discover, and you're not going to find a bigger advocate on this committee than me for you guys and for MinSCU, but I would struggle a little bit if I learned that we weren't taking care of those folks that are making it all happen for us so we can do the jobs we're hired for, and that we're not taking care of them appropriately, both financially and with benefits and hearing what their concerns are. And I realize that many of the historical reasons why there's been concerns is your predecessor created some of those problems for you, for sure. But I would want to know that you guys are going to be on the up and up and managing that. You can respond if you want now, but I wanted to bring that to light, and I expect to hear something back from you guys shortly on that.
President Kaler.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Chair Norness. Representative Isaacson, that is a complicated question, and frankly, it would need a team of our folks to touch on all of those areas. But we're committed to providing a fair and equitable workplace, a place where diversity is celebrated and a place where people see themselves spending their career. I mentioned previously the job family allocation that we're doing, which really lays a clear path for somebody to come in and progress from job to job at the U. I will admit that there are historical examples where we have not done what we should have done, and we're working assiduously to get rid of those. Again, we negotiate with our labor representative folks with a great deal of care. We provide a good benefit package, and we're attentive to the needs of our most lowly paid employees. So I'm comfortable with where we are. I'm certain we can get better, and I'd be delighted to sit with you and members of my team and go through your issues one by one if that would be acceptable to you.
Mr. Chair, that'd be fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to say a test would be to have the remaining questions come at you at one time. That would speed things up a little bit. We won't do that. Representative Whelan, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for being here today. I am also a graduate of the University of Minnesota, so it definitely has a warm place in my heart. And I have some questions, and I want to thank Representative Pawlowski actually for his comments too, which I think to me shed a light on the most important thing that we should be discussing is the students. And I know that there are students in the audience here too, and I want to do everything we can to rein in tuition for them. I have good friends that are really struggling with their debt right now, and so that's my number one priority. And I'm just wondering, I know you mentioned we can get a breakdown of the administrative costs that you guys are working on. I'm wondering if we can also get a breakdown of your requests here and even potentially a breakdown of your entire budget. I don't know if that's available publicly or not, but I'm just looking at, for example, at the Vital Communities, $1.75 million and then $2.75 million. And then what you're asking to do, you know, improving nutrition and enabling immigrant communities, which they sound nice, but it's kind of vague. And I know that the state does some of that already. So, you know, where's the overlap there? I'd be happy to hear your response.
President Karen Arnes, Representative Whalen, we could certainly get you very, very granular data. This is by design and direction, frankly, a high-level presentation. But each one of those is driven by very worthy activity. We've been mindful of overlap. We've been mindful of opportunities for collaboration. But we can get you that at a fine level for sure.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would really appreciate that. And again, thinking about potentially having to vote for allocating more money to the University of Minnesota, I would want to make sure that we're spending all of that correctly and that students are being taken care of first. So thank you.
Representative McDonald, we've been waiting for you.
You have?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I doubt that, but appreciate it. Flattery will get you everywhere. I have a softball question for you, President Kaler. I see that your budget request kind of goes back to 2008, which is what you mentioned. 2008 were happy times in Minnesota. As a businessman, working with fellow businessmen and families, there were good days. But we're not there yet. We're close, but we're not there yet. The economy is still quite fragile. And I think to get back to those levels with state funds is it's a lofty goal. I think it's too much. If you don't get to those goals, those numbers that you were requesting, will you go back to the marble of the meat in your budget, as you said, to try to find areas of cost savings, or will you have to increase the tuition?
President Kaler.
Chair Norris, Representative McDonald, the answer to that will depend very much on the structure of the ultimate allocation that this group makes to the university and the decision that the regents make in our budget. I would certainly have my preference to be looking at this as a holistic allocation, and if you're not able to allocate the entire amount, and I do agree it is an aggressive ask, it's on purpose an aggressive ask, I think you should get aggressive ask, that we would scale back and do what we could do, making tuition freezing, frozen tuition the highest priority.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you, President Kaler. So, as you mentioned earlier when Representative Pawlowski asked his questions, there are many priorities. Now, if there's everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. So I really hope that I heard you right, that if you don't get the appropriations that you request, that the priority of freezing tuition, which is kind of the theme around here, I think you can get it on both sides of the table here, that is the outgoing theme and the message that we'll strongly send. So is that what you said, then, that that'll be the top priority, then, to keep that fresh tuition frozen if you don't get the appropriations in the next biennium?
President Kaler.
Chair Norris, Representative McDonald, that is our highest priority. We will freeze tuition to the greatest degree we can with the allocation that you give us.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I liked your statement, except the last part with the appropriations that we give you, but I understand. Well,
Chair Norris, Representative McDonald, this is a budget that enables great things to be done at the University of Minnesota, and I would like to do those without asking students and their families for a tuition increase. And if that meant altering the amount of money that is in other buckets to be able to freeze tuition, that would be my priority.
We're going to go just a few minutes over time, if that's all right. Actually, I'm not asking for a response. We're going to go over. we're going to go over time. This is not a democracy. Representative Leon, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll spare the committee. Actually, my line of questioning has been asked by Representative Barrett, Pawlowski, and McDonald. So
As we do get further in depth in with some of these budget pictures with reserves, where some of the funding has gone from the $36 million, and where additional funding will go with the leftover $54 million that is to be in administrative costs, I'm sure I'll have more questions down the road. But for today, my questions have been asked, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And Representative Barrett, you found another question?
I do a quick one. And just follow up to what Representative Pawlowski was talking about, and I won't belabor the point, but back to institutional support and the fact that it went up around $60 million in 1 year, I think that is a good, for me, a good visual representation of the kind of questions and answers we have in our committee in order to understand why a support area went up $60 million at a time when you're trying to reduce costs, and whether those costs really were just moved to another area. I think if we can answer that question, we can find the root of whether we can freeze or actually lower tuition based on good stewardship of U of M resources. So, thank you.
Any final? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, I mean, we'll sit and dissect that particular function code for you. Okay. As I mentioned earlier, it is a catch-all of lots of different activity that goes on at the university. I'll give you another example of an expense that's being booked into institutional support that makes it volatile. We're currently, never asked the state for the money, we're currently spending a little over $83 million of university resources, reserves, to implement a new upgrade. We have to do an upgrade to our HR student and financial system. We expect to go live with that system in mid-April, and that's an expense that actually is a one-time expense that gets booked into institutional support. So we're happy to dissect that for you. It's there. You just got to peel the onion and let you know what's in there.
President Kaler, any final comments?
Chair Nornes, in the interest of time, members of the committee, I thank you very much for your attentiveness, and I thank you in advance for what I hope will be favorable conversations. Thank you for having me.
President Kaler, Dr. Jackson, Ms. Behringer, and Mr. Fritzenreiter. Members, the lights are still on. I was just fooling before. So. The meeting is adjourned.